My word. A panel game devised by Tony Schrein and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Pahl and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norton in a game about words, with Jack Longland in the chair.
And we go straight into the first round, which tests their respective vocabularies. So for two marks, what's the meaning of the following word? And Frank Muir, you begin with a furbelow.
Means almost what it sounds like.
That's right.
Fur below. Except it needn't necessarily be fur. It's a kind of frivolous decoration to the petticoat.
Yes. Yes.
Flounces and fur belows. It also, it's rather faintly derogatory, isn't it?
It is, particularly if used in the plural. And a lot of sort of showy ornaments, rather too many that you ought not to have. And you're absolutely right, Frank. Two marks. A pleated border at the hem of a petticoat, as Frank says, or skirt, a sartorial trimming, and much too showy in the plural, and it's also a kind of seaweed, but you'll not have to wear that at all. Too much. Anne Scott James. Now, this is difficult because there are two ways of pronouncing it, and I'll try both. It's a behemoth, B-E-H-E-M-O-T-H, or a behemoth, spelt the same way.
I'll settle for behemoth, Jack. It's a biblical Old Testament word.
Yes.
Meaning something large, I think, and alarming. An animal.
Yes. It's
a hairy mammal.
It comes in the book of Job. I think it's normally taken to be the hippopotamus, which they hadn't met very often. It was a bit alarming to meet a hippopotamus for the first time because it comes from an Egyptian word meaning the water ox, which is not a bad description of a hippopotamus, which otherwise eats weeds and grass. And it can be anything which is enormous in size. You're not quite certain what it is. You've met it in a nightmare. Two marks. Dennis Norton, yours is quite different. Schadenfreude.
Well, we're doing German words. Well, it's... I think it's more as a literary term more than anything else. A German word meaning... damage joy.
Yes.
And it's it's one of the reasons that certain people advance for why we laugh.
That's Clement Freuder.
It means I think actually it's the reason, it's the only reason why we laugh. It's the pleasure that we take from seeing somebody else's misfortune. If for example, you saw a chap jump on a bicycle without noticing that somebody had removed the saddle, that rather pleasant sensation that's aroused within you, that's called Schadenfreude.
If the saddle had just been loose, it would have been Lucienfreude.
We've got through the whole Freud family. Let me say that Dennis's description and examples were absolutely perfect, and he gets his two marks. Now, Dennis Powell, your word is gnomic.
I think it's something to do with knowing.
Yes.
It's being rather obscurely knowing, rather sort of learnedly knowing.
And what are you trying to do?
Divine, I think. It's kind of... It has a relation to the divine, hasn't it?
It might do.
Yes, yes. Yes, hasn't it?
It's an instruction.
Of course it has.
It's more like an instruction. I'm going to give you 1.5.
It's a message. It's a message downwards, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. It's sententious would be one description of it. Something consisting of general maxims or aphorisms or what you think are moral truths. And... you're trying to express some great truth in a very small number of extremely well-chosen words, and because there's a thing called the gnomic aorist, which, if we take an example, men were deceivers ever, which means they're still going on being deceivers now, But I think 1.5 would be a fair mark.
Or do not use while the train is standing at the station.
That's right. It's an even better example, yeah. Frank.
Do you remember the magazine John Bull used to do a competition called Bullets, in which you had to sort of write a whole picture in about 4 words? They were the most gnomic things I remember.
Yes, that's the point that did come out, that it's as short and pithy as possible. Now, before we go on to the next round, here are the quotations you've been given for the last round of all, and Frank, yours is, "Too many cooks spoil the broth," and yours, Dennis, is, "There's many a slip twixt the cup and the lip." And now a round of wise words about wit itself. So for 2 marks, can you identify the author of the following allegedly witty definitions? Beginning with Frank Muir again, he was a chronic sufferer from vertigo and said that wit in conversation is, in the midwife's phrase, a quick conception and an easy delivery.
It's a good line, isn't it? Very good.
He also said, "A nice man is a man of nasty ideas."
That's Swift.
Or rather, a clue.
That kind of line suited Swift's wit.
Now, what am I to give Frank?
None.
One. One. Now, it's Anne Scott James. An acknowledged master, which you can put into inverted commas if you prefer it, he said that wit ought to be a glorious treat like caviar and not spread about like marmalade.
Master in inverted commas?
Would it be the master?
The master?
Yes.
Yes,
Noel Coward, yes.
2 marks, Noel Coward it was, and he was known among some people as the master. Dennis Norden, your turn now. An American autocrat of the breakfast table, he said that the wit knows that his place is at the tail of the procession.
I haven't the faintest idea what the quotation means, but the autocrat of the breakfast table was Oliver Wendell Holmes.
That's a good clue, I thought. 2 marks. Dennis Powell, your turn. With a name sounding like a sneeze, this German philosopher said that wit was the epitaph of an emotion.
All German philosophers sound like a sneeze.
Do I have sneezed?
You needn't, you can just
sneeze.
No.
Nietzsche.
Yes, that was the philosopher Nietzsche, and he said that wit was the epitaph of an emotion. Well, now let's get on to something quite different, because it is a round of differences. For 2 marks, what's the difference in meaning between the following 2 words, beginning again with Frank Muir, and your 2 are, Frank, and they're most inappropriate, rotund and orotund?
In the early 18th century, James Thompson described a rich little cleric of the time as a little, round, oily man of God. Now, the little, round, oily man of God would have looked rotund, and his sermons would have been orotund.
I think that would do rather nicely. 2 marks. And Scott James, your 2 are sympathy and empathy.
A sympathy means when you feel alongside or with another person.
Yes.
And what's empathy? A pain in your middle, I think.
No, I think sympathy is when you understand what a person's feeling, and empathy is when you actually are capable of experiencing the same emotion yourself. I think when husbands, when wives are going to have babies and the husbands get pains, you know, that's empathizing, whereas sympathizing is when they say, "Shouldn't you sit down, dear?"
But just before you sit down, would you mind handing my boots?
Would you mind? No.
Horse
would
that trunk over there and push the table right.
That's right.
2 marks straight away. Dennis Norden, pathos and bathos.
And D'Artagnan. well pathos is a kind of a literary or theatrical device by which you excite or inspire pity.
Yes.
And bathos is a kind of failed pathos. It the example of bathos, I remember, I think it's in Three Men in a Boat, where K. Jerome says, but we did not sail into a world of golden sunset. We went smack into an old lady in a punt.
That'll do. 2 marks straight away. Mm. Now, Dillis Powell, your two, are prolixity and verbosity. Prolixity and verbosity.
Well, they both mean talking a great deal.
Yes.
I think prolixity means talking too much, really. Verbosity was referred to by Disraeli. Exuberance of his own verbosity.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. He spoke too much in public. Prolixity, I think, rather going on too long.
Prolixity in literature, and also in speech, means you keep on dwelling on detail far too much. You're telling a story and you put in the colour of the 15th person in the back row, put in the colour of their hair.
You have to in radio.
Whereas verbosity simply means too many words anyway. There is a slight difference, though not a great one. Well, now we have a quick round entitled New Similes for Old. So for 2 marks, can you suggest a newer and more up-to-date version of the following perhaps rather overworked similes? So, Frank Muir, what would you suggest instead of as cool as a cucumber?
It would be nice to have another food simile, but the only one I can think of is as cool as a peppermint after curry. But I think as cool as clean sheets.
Ah, that's nice. I think that would do rather nicely. 2 marks. And Scott James, instead of as poor as a church mouse.
As poor as a church mouse. As poor as an orphan in the third world. Let's be serious for once. Right.
Yeah, 2 marks straight away in that case. Dennis, instead of as slippery as an eel, as slippery as what?
As slippery as cold boiled spaghetti eaten with chopsticks.
Can't catch that. Dillis Powell, yours, instead of as nervous as a kitten, as nervous as?
As nervous as the Chancellor about to announce his mini-budget.
So now we come to the last round, and to Frank and Dennis's quotations, and the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. And Frank, your quotation is, "Too many cooks spoil the broth," which I think is a proverb. And, Frank, what are you going to do with that proverb?
Herewith, the complete and utter history of Scotland. And in order to persuade our overseas listeners who might be coming to England to visit Scotland, I want to tell them the whole history of Scotland. I've researched it in depth. Well, not really in depth, because I researched it last Tuesday morning at the Literary Institute in Egham. But I didn't take a notebook, and all I had to write down the facts was the back of a parking fine notification. Scotland is, if you look at a map and take Britain as a chap in a very large hat riding a pig westward, Scotland is the head of Britain, down to the Adam's apple. And then you get Northumberland, you see. It's very ancient. Religion came to Scotland really quite early on, from Ireland. The monks sailed round and tried to establish religion in England on the island of Lindisfarne, but it didn't take, and they ended up as a pop group. And they had more success in Scotland on the Isle of Iona. And one of the original foundations of religion in Scotland was St. Andrews. and it was the university was founded there. It was the cathedral city at the beginning of the 15th century. In medieval times in Scotland, the youth of the town used to engage into warring factions every Saturday afternoon, and used to fight. They were the Celtics and the Rangers. And their fighting often went on way into the evening. Historians remember that as the Wars of the Razors. Edinburgh, too, was another city, which is now the capital city, which was famous for the festival, and Edinburgh Rock, which isn't like Blackpool Rock. And when you bite it, it sort of crumbles in a sort of rather oddly disturbing powdery way, as though a very old wisdom tooth has at last gone. Life in the Highlands was even tougher than life in the Lowlands, and typical Scots dress was a simple kilt. And if you're worried what a Highlander wore beneath his kilt, well, I can tell you that any self-respecting Highlander did and still does wear beneath his kilt socks and then shoes. to keep themselves warm at night on the Highlands, they used to dip their plaid, which is a kind of shoulder blanket, into water, wring it out, and roll up, and that kept them warm all night. They dip into any convenient burn, Scottish word for stream, and that kept them warm. Now, these Highland warriors were so tough that this lot, who used to go through this practice of dipping their plaid in water, were the nucleus of the now famous Coldstream Guards. Highland games they also played, and these reached their zenith in Victorian times when at Braemar, when Queen Victoria and many of her cabinet ministers used to come up and watch them. And there the famous game was tossing the caber, in which a very powerful Scot would pick up a telegraph pole some 40 feet in length, run with it as long as he was able, and then toss it high in the air, the aim being that it fell on the head of the English Minister for Scottish Affairs. Many Scotland stopped the death penalty for any other than the most awful crimes in 1794. And the last public execution was at Anstruther in 1804, when Sandy Sanderson was beheaded for whistling on Sunday. By far the prettiest part of Scotland are the fishing towns and villages on the east coast of the Kingdom of Fife and of Angus. And the prettiest of all of these is St. Andrews. Now, it has been said that Arbroath is prettier, but some people say this isn't so because of the religious revival in the 19th century, when there are so many Scottish churches there. There was the Church of Scotland, there was the United Free, the We Free Church, there were the Evangelist churches. Instead of building just one kirk on the hill, each of these six built four churches each on every street corner. Hence this, I think, rather sort of unfair but old Scottish proverb about the town: too many kirks spoil Arbroath.
Frank will need a bodyguard next time he goes north of the border. But now let's see how you get on, Dennis, with your quotation, which was, "There's many a slip 'twixt the cup and the lip." Dennis?
Russell Brick. I'm sorry. I do apologise. I did it again. I went right off there. "As fast asleep." Isn't it awful? It's happening every week now. While Frank's telling his story, I find my lids getting heavier and heavier, and then my eyes get that sort of double glazing, and before I know it, I'm gone. what I must explain, though, is it's absolutely no reflection on Frank or the astonishingly amusing stories that he tells. It's simply the consequence of my chronic insomnia. I've always slept badly, but lately it's just getting impossible. Night after night, I just lie there. I don't know if any of you suffer from insomnia. But you know what I find the worst part about it? It's those extraordinary thoughts that come into your head. You find yourself worrying about the most ridiculous things, like, how did Adam keep his fig leaf on? Or what do you call a male ladybird? Why do you never hear of anybody catching their death of hot? Or if all the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players, where do audiences come from? You see, and that sort of totally futile speculation just goes sort of tumble-drying round in the brain. And or the next thing you know, it's suddenly light and there's that sort of clink, clink, you know, feelings, woo-hoo-hoo, it's the milkman. And all you know is it's another night, and the only certainty that you get is that you're going to spend the next 16 hours just flopping about like a limp rag, because all that medical science really knows about sleep, the phenomenon called sleep, is that it's something which, if you don't get any the night before, you spend the whole of the next day half a. Right? What's more, anybody like me who has real insomnia knows better than to put any faith at all in all those cures that people keep recommending to you. No. Try blotting out the light by wearing one of those sleep masks. Well, I tried that. You can't say I didn't try. I put one on. It's like a kind of elasticated blindfold. And two things happened. The first one was about 5 a.m. I got very thirsty. So I fumbled for the glass of water on my bedside table, took a sip, went to put it back, and poured the whole lot over myself. And 2 hours later, my little godson, who was staying with us, wandered in, took one look at me, and then went rushing back to his mother, shouting, "You're wrong, you're wrong, I've just seen Batman, and he does wet the bed." Take that other well-known last resort, sleeping pills. It's another dead loss, absolute dead loss. You know, all sleeping pills nowadays come in those special bottles that children can't open. I can't open them either. All that bottle of pills did for me was I had to struggle so hard to get the top off, I finally fell asleep from sheer exhaustion. And even that didn't help, because even when I did sleep, I dreamt I was awake. You get that? You see, but as a consequence of all that, this intensely humiliating development has taken place. You see, because of the long friendship that's existed between Frank and myself, his voice has now become the only sound in the world that I find reassuring enough to lull me to sleep, you see. So, in other words, Frank's story now provides the only decent kip I get all week. Well, even worse than that, if it wasn't for an arrangement that Miss Scott James and myself have come to, I'd probably still be sleeping when they're playing the closing signature tune, you see, but what we have agreed, Anne and I have agreed, is the moment the studio audience begins its storm of applause for Frank's brilliant punchline, she drops her hand, you see, beneath the table, and between her well-manicured forefinger and thumbnail, she gives me a short, sharp nip on the thigh, you see, which wakes me up in time to start my dissertation, you see. But today, unfortunately, as you all witnessed, it would appear that I was sitting a little bit too far away for her nails to reach my thigh. Mind you, that still wasn't as embarrassing as the time I sat myself a little too close. But just in case I ever happen to oversleep again on this program, perhaps the listeners will now appreciate what goes on this side of the microphone during Frank's applause. There's many a kip twixt the clap and the nip.
And by your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Dennis Norden wins the story, and he and Anne Scott James also win this entire contest this week.
Taking part in My Word were Anne Scott James, Dillis Powell, Dennis Norden, and Frank Muir. The chairman was Jack Longland. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the program was produced by Tony Shrine.